Welcome to Vox Talks Economics, recorded live at the PSE CEPR Policy Forum 2025. My name is Tim Phillips. In this episode, 3 of the next generation of economists. At Vox Talks Economics, we bring you new research from today's best economists. But when we visit a conference, we always like to feature some of tomorrow's best economists as well. As usual, at the forum, a group of young researchers have been presenting their work in the main theatre, also during the breaks. And I had the opportunity to talk to 3 of them about their research. So in this episode, you'll hear from Nathan Vieira of Aix-Marseille University, Deepakshi Singh of the University of Groningen, and first of all, Pelin Özgül of the University of Maastricht. Pelin, you're investigating the impact of AI on productivity. I have seen all sorts of press releases from tech firms with predictions that AI is already making us, one of them said 70% more productive. How much serious evidence do we have on this?
Well, I do find 70% a bit too extreme, like you, Tim, and also a bit unrealistic in our current reality. Because most of these numbers come from lab experiments or studies in very controlled settings and mainly focusing on very specific array of tasks and also mainly covering usages of a specific type of AI, generative AI technologies like LLMs, such as ChatGPT, a very well-known example. And in real workplace settings, in firms, I think it's much harder and complicated to achieve such dramatic gains. First, the effect size, I think, and even the direction, whether it's negative or positive, that depends heavily on the job and the context on the AI is actually implemented. Whether it's replacing the tasks, whether it's supporting the workers, I think that design choice matters a lot. And also, many of these predictions overlook a very important reality. It's just not about what the AI can do, whether the technical availability or the feasibility, but it's also the organizational dynamics. How the workplaces and the workers adapt, whether they accept that technology, how the workflows change, whether they are comfortable using this technology as part of their job. I think all these aspects critically shape whether these productivity gains can be achieved or not.
Right. Now, you selected a particular workplace, a particular occupation. Which one?
So in our study, we focused on the call center agents in a financial firm in Europe. And we think that this is a really good setting because, first of all, the tasks are structured in the setting. It is regularly monitored and it is also recorded. But it's also performed by a mix of low, mid and high skilled workers. And also in a more broad sense, the customer contact centers are one of the industries where the AI adoption is escalating very rapidly. So using chatbots or call routing or making like automated performance feedbacks, these are the applications that we see AI is taking a lot of space. So these occupations are also a frontline example of how AI is actively shaping the work and the workplaces.
We think we know what happens in call centers. I'm not sure I know in any detail, though. What do these people actually do?
Yeah, indeed, it's a diverse set of tasks. But in our setting, our call center agents, their main task is to answer incoming customer calls and to provide support to the customers related to any problems, questions, complaints that these customers might have. So their job does not only require the technical knowledge on the firm's products and the services that they are offering, but also strong communication and problem-solving skills because they need to help their customers to support.
And we think we know what productivity is as well, but how is their performance measured?
It's also very, of course, context dependent, but productivity is within a firm. So in our setting, the performance is measured through a metric called average handle time, which is the average duration to handle a customer call. And the firm also uses this as the main metric to evaluate their agent's performance. And it also has 3 components. So the total time that is spent on speaking, in silence, and the time that the customer was put on hold. And all these metrics make like the average handle time of a call.
Now, the reason we can investigate the impact of AI here is because it was used for training, wasn't it? So what was the previous training regime without AI and how did they use AI to improve that?
So I think it's very important to tell that the AI is implemented mainly to support the coaching regime of these contact agents. So after starting the department, these agents follow a regular one-on-one coaching session with their assigned coaches, which is aimed to improve their performance. Before AI, this coaching relied on reviewing 3 manually selected calls per agent. So the coaches would select these calls among all the calls that the agent had been doing since the last time they had their training. They would listen to these 3 calls, and based on the content of these 3 calls, they would provide their coaching accordingly, which was quite a data poor environment, led to selection issues because the entire regime was dependent on these 3 calls being representative of the agent's performance. And that meant there was lack of objectivity, uniformity, and even sometimes caused conflict between the agent and the coach. And for that reason, the firm implemented an AI, a supervised language processing algorithm that listens and transcribes all calls. And it also generates a performance dashboard for the agents. And that includes the performance for the agent for each call. And that performance dashboard is then given to the coach who implemented to the training regime.
If you're seeing improvement in performance, how do you know that it's the AI that's responsible for that?
That's definitely the key question.
It is.
How do we know it is causal? We know that because the way that this training, this AI system is implemented, it is introduced in a gradual manner, so in a staggered manner. And this rollout took place in 2023 at a team level, once in May and in July. So that created a really nice quasi-experimental setup for us to observe and compare the outcomes across treated group agents who received this AI-enhanced coaching and the control group agents who followed their coaching under the standardized coaching regime with the 3 calls over time.
Okay, Belen, you got to give me the results. What were you measuring? What was the improvement?
We do find that this improved productivity. We use this average handle time as the main measure for our main worker productivity. We find that it reduced the average handle time about 60 seconds, which translates to about 10% improvement in worker productivity. We observe that these gains are primarily driven by reductions in their speak time and hold time. So the workers are speaking less, but also the time that they put the customer on hold is also less. We also find some improvements in their communication quality. We find that they reduce the usage of certain inefficient words, such as like filler words or stop words, that suggests a better conversational clarity.
Very often when you have training like this, it's the really bad people that improve. Did everyone get better or was it just the poor performers?
We do find that all agents benefit from this AI-enhanced coaching, but the magnitude and the nature effects vary by experience level, indeed. So we do find largest productivity gains that occurs among agents with the short tenure, so the agents with less than 4 months of experience. For this group, we observe significant reductions in their average handle time, also in their speak, hold, and silence time. What we do see for experienced agents, so those with 5+ months of tenure, we do see notable improvements in their communication quality. So they reduce the usage of filler words in a larger extent. So while this AI-enhanced coaching helps these novice agents improve their efficiency and core competences, it also helps experienced agents refining their expertise.
Amazing news for employers. Is it good news for the people who work in the call center? Do you know if they're happier?
I really like this question a lot because I think it also shows how important it is to consider the worker side of the story, which is, as I said, in the key. We do not have in the setting a direct measure for job satisfaction for the quantitative analysis, but for that reason, we've conducted interviews with the agents and the coaches before and after this AI was implemented. And we find that the overall experience was quite positive because the agents saw that the feedback was much more data-driven and it was much more objective. So from the agent side, of course, there were some concerns that it did induce extensive monitoring. So for some, everything became a bit too negative in the beginning, but overall, they were happy with that. It was there to support them because they did know that they were working with AI and that the AI was not there to replace them or anything, but to help them. And for the coach's side, they also saw that it made them a better coach because it was really clear what the AI was providing. And it was also up to the coach to take that information and apply it to the regime.
Nathan, do you have a question for Pelin?
Yeah, as we use AI, we also learn how to use AI and we are developing some AI-related skills and how those skills will be important in the future of work since now maybe our productivity will depend on them.
I do think AI skills will become increasingly important. I think the more that the AI is integrated into our, not only our work, but also our personal lives, I do think that it is becoming a crucial point. It's not just also in tech-heavy jobs, but across wide ranges of tasks and the sectors. I don't mean that it's developing AI models or becoming very heavy coders, but it's also the ability to understand, to interpret, to communicate what you want from the system, and also to interpret the output that you get. I think that's going to be a very crucial factor for your productivity.
Deepakshi.
Are there any barriers like cost or resistance or any ethical concerns that might be related to such AI trainings and which might also sort of hinder the scalability of such trainings?
Absolutely. I think that's a very, very crucial part of the story because of this whole ethics and the data governance issues, because it is a tool that heavily monitors the performance. And I think it's very important to know that for that reason, everyone should be in place. And with our firm, we did meet the data scientists and they had a very pro-human-centric vision. And for them, it was really clear what they wanted to achieve, that was to help the workers. And I think that attitude also helped the acceptance of the technology by the agents, by the coaches that created this positive outcome. But it is, I think, very important and it's a very crucial topic to discuss this whole ethical issues regarding this AI adoption.
Yeah, that's going to be very, very important in an industry that hasn't always treated its employees well. Thank you very much for that, Pelin.
In the last few years, the students we featured on these episodes of Vox Talks Economics have gone on to finish their PhDs and join the academic staff at major universities all over the world. Some have even won awards for the research that they discussed with us. If you follow Vox Talks wherever you get your podcasts, you can find all of our previous Young Economist special episodes.
Nathan, you've been investigating short-time work. Can you explain what the principle of short-time work is and where it's used?
Short-time work is a job retention scheme. That is a program where us collectively, we decide to subsidize some low-productive jobs. And the specificity that I try to demonstrate in the paper is that in those programs, it is more or less the firm who decides how much subsidy they're going to get. The key difference between short-time work and other job retention scheme is that it relies on a hours mechanism. That is, when a firm benefits from the program, they can decide to cut the number of hours worked by their worker, and they're going to just pay them based on this new hours basis. And so if they want to, in some countries, they can just make you stop working and stop paying you. The question always with those programs is how much we should spend on it and how much jobs should we save thanks to those public expenditure.
Being British, there definitely are countries where they can just tell you to stop working, stop paying you. There are three actors here, aren't there? There's the worker, the employer, and the policymaker, the government. What is the benefit to each?
For the firm, obviously, is that they can go through some periods where they maybe face some business difficulties and keep their worker at a lower labor cost. For the worker, they reduce their number of hours worked, so everyone's happier when they work less, I believe. Mm-hmm. And also they receive a compensation from the state, so their revenue are preserved. For the policymaker, the main benefit is that it might prevent massive layoffs and so a lot of workers going on the labor market while the labor market might not be able to quickly or efficiently relocate them to other firms. So in the literature, I've shown that the program was efficient in saving jobs and it is on average less costly than relying on alternative unemployment or job retention programs.
But you have to set a level for this, don't you? Which is what your work is all about. How are the costs and the compensation set at the moment in places that employ short-term work?
Exactly. So the key monetary incentives, I believe, in those programs are how much the firm is going to participate in the compensation received by the worker. In most countries, this share of compensation paid by the firm are zero. But when you increase this share paid by the firm, then the program is less attractive for firms because the program becomes more costly. And as the program is less attractive, either firms will continue to use it, but just maybe set a number of hours worked a bit bigger than before, because now adjusting at the hours margin is more costly. Or maybe they will choose to not use the program and lay off the worker, maybe even if they're going to rehire him afterwards.
You have established that there's this trade-off here between protecting jobs and reducing hours. Can you explain how that trade-off is going to work?
The thing is that when you play with the cost paid by firms, as said, you play with the intensive use of the program, that is how much hours will be cut, but you also play with the extensive use of the program, that is how much workers going to be enrolled in the program and theoretically how much jobs going to be saved. On the one hand, when you lower the contribution paid by firm, indeed, more workers theoretically going to be saved, but it will be at higher cost for the policymakers, and all workers that were already enrolled in the program will then become more costly for policymakers because they're going to work less and policymakers going to finance a higher share of their compensation. So the trade-off is really about how much money we want to invest in those jobs and how much jobs should we save.
Now, this seems like a classic economist's problem. Is the most efficient solution for this that you could find, is that feasible?
Indeed, ideally, we should set two incentives. One to regulate the number of hours worked by the worker, and another to regulate the number of jobs saved. The thing is that we only have got one tool, that is the share of compensation paid by the firm. So either you go for the number of jobs saved, or either you go for the number of hours worked and the public expenditure. What I try to show in the paper is that we have favored too much the number of workers enrolled in the program. And so the program is too costly for policymakers. And I believe that reading a bit the participation of firms in OECD countries will not have a big effect of unemployment, but then will cut public expenditure drastically.
Yeah, how are you modeling this so that you can discover what the optimal policy might be?
In the paper, I create a simple model to draw from theoretical intuition, and then I try to develop in a more complex model that I try to estimate. But the simple model is just a firm who's matched with a worker, they agree on a wage, and then they might experience a business or demand shock. And where they experience those demand shock, the firm will then decide to cut the number of hours worked by their worker. Then this decision of cutting the number of hours worked ultimately depends on this short-term compensation. And so the higher the compensation paid by the firm, the lower the firm will be willing to decrease the number of hours worked. So that's how I model the firm's decision to cut hours of work. And then the classic decision is that the firms compare a situation where they keep the worker and the situation where they laid off the worker. And so the higher the compensation paid by firms, the more likely the firm's going to choose to lay off the worker.
How well has France used this policy? How much better could it do if it used it in the future?
I focus on the French case because I found that France has set one of the highest short-term compensation of OECD countries. So I'm like, okay, if I focus on France and I found that even one of the highest short-term compensation set in OECD countries is too low, imagine what it would be for other OECD countries. Mm-hmm. And currently, since 2023, the short-term compensation paid by firms are set at 36% of the wage. What's good with the models, I can derive some optimal first and second best policy, and I estimate that actually, those short-term compensation should be set at 51% of the wage. And by moving from 36 to 50%, I estimate that we would almost cut public expenditure. So I estimate a decrease of 96%. We would increase the welfare of short-term workers because as they're working more, they're producing more. And so there are more revenue to redistribute. And we will barely affect the unemployment threshold because as the short-term work program is already very attractive, lowering this attractiveness would not have any big effect on the number of workers enrolled in the program.
Your model suggests that many countries set this short-time work cost too low, which creates inefficiencies. But how much of that do you think is a deliberate policy choice? Or do you think this is more of a result of this design oversight, so where the policymakers underestimate these trade-offs due to the lack of tools or the evidence that you nicely showed?
This is a nice question because I don't know the answer. We have to do some historical analysis. Most countries didn't have any short-time work program before the Great Recession. Mm-hmm. I can count maybe five countries on the top of my head. And after the Great Recession and the success of the German labor market that was then nicknamed the Second German Miracle, a lot of countries have implemented short-time work program based on the German ones. And at that time, the German short-time work program was built around this zero short-time cost for firms. So to know why currently in OECD countries, short-time compensation paid by firms are too low, we need to know why before the Great Recession, Germany have chosen such a program. And I think that then we have to go on policy analysis and maybe political ideology. The thing is that I believe that since then, we have a lot of focus on the effect of those programs on unemployment and not that much on the cost for policymakers. And I think that now evidence are changing and focus of research are changing. And we are more and more able, as we know more and more about short-term work programs, to provide some policy guidance. And I believe that in the future, this short-term compensation will be more of a discussion than it was in the past.
I had a question related to the idea if short-time work might crowd out other forms of adjustment, such as wage renegotiation or internal reallocation, or even upskilling within the firms.
Yeah, so actually short-time work is built for rigid economies. So you can see as the way you want. Either the economy is already rigid and then short-time work helps the economy and the labor adjustment to be more flexible. But then again, as you make the rigid economy and the rigid contracts more flexible, you encourage less for more flexible contracts. And like currently, if you look, I think in the UK, it is hard to adapt those programs to gig workers. And so there's always this question on, should we encourage more flexible form labor contracts or should we keep those contracts as a basis and try to adapt our labor market program to improve what we already have? And so that will be a topic of policy and public discussion.
This is so relevant to the future of work, especially in Europe. So thanks for talking about it today. Dipaksha, you're asking about whether droughts affect female employment in India, and a question that might have a very obvious answer. Why is it important to discover what the impact of droughts is in India?
India, over the past decade, has seen an increasing incidence of climate shocks, particularly droughts, and also the severity of these shocks occurring within the country. And it's not just limited to rural regions, but it's also being experienced by urban areas. And so it sort of creates an interesting dynamic to look at and also understand if we want to develop policies for adaptation and mitigation. That's why studying such a topic in the Indian context not only helps us understand what might we incur in the future when such intensities increase and occurrences of such shocks increase, but also what we might incur and what we might have to deal with specifically in terms of women and their employment and labor market dynamics in the Indian context.
Yes. Why are you looking at women's employment in particular?
Many a times it is the women who often are the hidden shock absorbers in instances of such climate shocks and crises. And their responses to such shocks like droughts are not just shaped by economic needs, but more so by the entrenched gender norms present within these areas. And so examining women's employment helps understand how household labor decisions are reorganized during such climate shocks and whether this leads to empowerment in some cases or maybe a deeper precarity.
What data can you use for this investigation? How much data do you have over what period?
So the data that I'm using for my paper is from the demographic and health surveys data. And it is a highly representative data subnationally for the Indian context, I would say. So we have about 1.19 million observations, and we use the data from 2005 till 2019, 20 waves, so three waves of the DHS. But I also make use of the National Sample Survey data, the NSS, and the Periodic Labor Force Survey data of India for my robustness checks in the paper. So it's a mixed set of data sets that we use.
So I'm going to ask that causal question again. How can you be sure that it's the impact of droughts on the labor force that you're seeing?
In that context, the model that we use plays an important role. So we are using a linear probability model with fixed effects. And we also control for time invariant unobserved heterogeneity, which helps us to isolate the impacts of droughts on female labor market or employment impacts.
Okay, so to the results, do droughts lead to an increase in female employment? What types of work does it influence?
We find that droughts do lead to an increase in female employment. However, that increase stems from jobs which belong to categories of low-skilled occupations or low-paying occupations. So it's not so much an empowerment or betterment story, but rather a more distress-driven employment story.
And you wanted also to understand the impact on gender bias norms. What indicators are you using here? What does this tell us?
The indicators that we're using to understand gender bias norms include women's educational enrollment, which was historically been seen to be impacted in instances of such crises. We also look at women's mobility and migration, so if that's impacted during shocks. And we also look at son preferences, which has historically been seen to increase when there is a crisis like war or climate shocks or even economic crisis. And so in our data, we look at the variables such as the gender of the last born child in order to look at son preferences. We look at migration data and we look at educational enrollment. And we find that there is an increase in son preferences when exposed to droughts. There is a fall in female educational enrollment. And we find that mobility or migration also reduces for women. So social norms overall do become more restrictive.
So this is very interesting because what on the surface might look like a good news story, that increase in employment, turns out that maybe this isn't quite as good news as it seems. We have that impact on autonomy and jobs maybe aren't the best quality jobs. Maybe it's not that good news at all.
Exactly. On the surface, higher employment during drought shocks might look like progress or maybe betterment. But deeper analysis, as we found, shows that it is distress-driven and it's not a good picture that comes out of it. It underscores the need for more, I believe, policy responses and more proactive action on climate policy, which also takes into account gender differences.
You mentioned some spillover effects of this women participation. Do you observe other changes on those gender norms, such as, like, for instance, shift on household responsibilities or increased in sharing housework in your research?
Very interesting question and also something that I am trying to look at. However, we do not particularly focus on that in this paper, but this is a crucial question which needs to be looked at. And while the paper that I'm studying does not directly address it, we can infer from insights that are available to us from other research in this area. I think the two key aspects that we can look at is the whole aspect of time use. And the recent time use survey research in India has showed that even when women's employment increases or their participation in the labor market increases, the household dynamics do not change much. So the household labor division still is very unbiased towards women. And so they are more burdened with household work or domestic responsibilities as well as working outside. Household dynamics take a little longer to change. And that also indicates towards the normative stickiness of such social norms and where cultural expectations are believed to change slower in comparison to labor market changes. Change might come eventually, but not as quick.
You find that the droughts lead to a rise in female employment, but mostly in low-paid, low-skilled informal work. So I was thinking, can we think of this as more of a positive coping mechanism or more like an indicator of that there is an increased vulnerability further for the woman?
I wouldn't look at it as a more positive coping mechanism. I think it is, like I mentioned, more sort of a distress coping mechanism, especially given that social norms are still becoming more stringent. However, what would be interesting in this scenario would be to look at more long-term impacts. Right now, our study focuses mostly on short-term due to data restrictions. But more long-term impacts might help reveal that if women do continue to stay employed or in the employment labor market, then it might have some positive effects.
Thank you so much. There is so much interesting gender-based research going on at the moment. We have one more question for you. I want to ask you, say you were invited back to your high school. You would be a hero going back. And you had to talk to the students about studying economics. What thing would you tell them, good or bad?
I'd say make the concept your own. Economy, use statistics, mathematics as a language to express and demonstrate ideas. But the key part is ideas. And first of all, you gotta make ideas yours using maybe your language, your own words, to really understand them, and then use mathematics, statistics as a tool to show them to others. But don't be that stressed about sometimes the mix that you got between complex econometrical models to demonstrate complex ideas. Most of papers and most of great researches can be summarized with few words. And read those few words at the basis of the great research.
Good advice.
I would add that when you encounter economics in high school, it might seem too big subject and too complex a subject to deal with. But keep in mind that your everyday functioning in life deals with the basic concepts of economics. And just be observant, look at that, and then adapt it in your own way and styles.
Pelin.
Not to diminish the type of work that we're doing or the complexity, but I've heard once that even the most complicated regression is about simple averages. And I think keeping that in mind and being also very open to what's happening in the world. And what I also really like about economics is that it's such an interdisciplinary field that you work around many topics using very different ideologies. Don't make it too complicated for you and just follow what you're interested in. And I'm sure there will be a find for you to do your analysis in a very fancy way.
Three pieces of good advice. I hope you do get invited back. For now, our job is done, though. Pelin, thank you.
Thank you very much for having me.
Deepakshi.
Thank you very much.
And Nathan.
Thank you, Tim.
So those papers, Artificial Intelligence in Coaching, Improving Productivity and Communication Quality for Call Center Agents. And the authors, Didier Fouag, Marie-Christine Fregin, Simon Janssen, Mark Levels, Raymond Montizan, Pelin Özgül, Nicholas Rounding, and Michael Stops. The Deadweight Loss of Short-Time Work, Nathan Vieira. And Weathering Labour Market Shocks, Droughts and Gendered Employment in India, Deepakshi Singh and Anna Munishan.
Vox Talks Economics is a Talk Normal production. The assistant producer is Megan Bieber, and our editor is Andrei Zagarian. Next time on Vox Talks Economics, gender and the labour market.